frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on June 25th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, returning guest Emily Robinson, a socialist organizer from Virginia currently based in Scotland, comes back on the show to talk about the successful 2017 Labour campaign under Jeremy Corbyn, the aftermath including the Grenfell fire, and what's next for UK Labour. All that is coming up. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Scotland, again returning to the show, is our guest, Emily Robinson. Hi, Emily. Welcome back.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
So the last time that you were on the show was right after the U.S. presidential election. not a great time for all of us and pretty gloomy, I think. But you were certainly sounding some cautious notes of optimism regarding the Labour Party's prospects over in the UK, because obviously you're both involved in US politics and in UK politics since you're over there now. And then there was, you know, at the time you were thinking that the election was going to be like 2020. And then a few months ago, the Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May called an early election. And I remember that the day that the early election was called, you were very pessimistic about how things were going because you thought that this was too soon, basically, for Labour to get its act together to mount an effective campaign and, you know, that this was going to basically destroy the left before it could have a chance to prove itself. I think, you know, on the grounds that, you know, if it had gone as badly as people thought that it was maybe going to go at the start of the campaign, then this would have been taken by the Blairites as a sign that, like, you know, that the left had failed and clearly couldn't win elections. But instead, tell me what happened in the election.
Well, I will say I'm very, very, very proudly excited, I would say, to take my mea culpa here. I will admit that I just said on Twitter a couple hours ago that I said at one point, Labour will be dead and Momentum will be making memes about its death. And Labour is not dead and Momentum is still making memes, but they're doing really well. So what actually happened was Theresa May, about 7 weeks ago, called a snap election because she was facing a little bit of inner turmoil in her party regarding the Brexit negotiations, which just started this past week. And in order to sort of stifle the dissent within her party, she wanted to call a snap election to shore up her mandate and really silence her critics. I think it was the Daily Mail, which is a right-wing newspaper here, ran with the headline, Crush the Opposition, or something like that. So she ran, well, her and the Tories actually, based on the campaign Donald Trump ran, which was a very sort of single, you know, great man of history-based, anti-sort of political, anti-policy-based campaign. And it was a lackluster campaign, but on the other side, on my side, on Jeremy Corbyn's side, we ran what was frankly one of, I think, the best run campaigns we have seen, God, in the left in a long, long time, possibly since 1945. We managed to decrease the Tory majority to the point where they didn't have a single number of members of parliament who could vote through the Queen's Speech, which is this sort of parliamentary kind of not technicality, but
it's like a mechanism.
Yeah. It's sort of this frivolous old sort of standard of politics in the UK that certifies that a government has a right to govern. Because the Tories didn't have the numbers they needed to pass the Queen's speech on their own, they started having to look elsewhere, including the DUP, occasionally the Lib Dems, but the Lib Dems didn't really go their favor. But anyway, so the reason that we're really optimistic about this is because Labour did what the commentary had told us we couldn't do, and that was we took the Tories down. So the Tories aren't a dead party yet, but they're floundering. Actually, I think in a lot of ways the Democratic Party back in the U.S. is floundering. They're not used to having been beaten by someone who they had been told by the commentary, by the pundit class, was sort of this maverick weirdo who had no appeal. And instead they were pretty much crushed. We took a seat in Canterbury that since its inception in the 1400s had never been a Labour seat. Since I think the late 1800s had never been anything but a Tory seat. So we ran a really, really incredible campaign, defeated the Tories, at least in one sense, and might be looking down another election soon.
Yeah, it's, I think, very encouraging for a lot of us who feel like there's not really much happening over here in terms of rebuilding the party. But it's, you know, like you said, obviously, you know, Labour still didn't win the election, but the gap at the beginning was 20 points in the polling, and that was closed to what, like 1 point or so. And then it seems like after the election, now that he's proven that he's credible, not only does he seem like he's acting more prime ministerial, the media seems to be treating him like that a bit more, and the voters seem to be taking him a lot more seriously in the post-election polling. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. So I actually think one of the key points here that is often not brought up is media impartiality rules here in the UK. They're a lot more stringent here about how media works and how media operates in the UK versus the US. So at the start of this election, which was called, there's a specified amount of time that elections can happen. And during this time, what happens is the BBC, as this sort of state actor and oversight of the media in the UK, has rules and regulations on how much airtime parties are allowed to have. So, you know, prior to the election being called, these rules weren't in place. So the Tories could suck up 90, 98, 99% of the airtime. And the only airtime that would be devoted to Labour would be purely negative, sort of Jeremy Corbyn's a nut job. He doesn't know what he's doing. But once these media impartiality rules came into effect at the start of the campaign, the media started to have to treat him seriously, or at least as a normal person, which they didn't have to do before. And as we can see with the polling gaps, the minute these media impartiality rules came into effect, the polls really started changing. And I don't necessarily think it's that Corbyn has started acting more prime ministerial. He's acting the same way he's always been. But during that election campaign, the media stopped being able to sort of treat him like a crazy old man. And they started having to recognize, you know, the type of person he's always been. And I think one of the really amazing things, I was just looking at a poll a couple minutes ago that showed the approval rating of Theresa May as negative 17 versus Jeremy Corbyn, whose approval rating is something like 17, which is, or plus 17, which is really, really incredible, all things considered. And I think one of the things that, you know, we have to be wary of the volatility of polling, but it does say quite a bit that Labour is polling as well as it is. And, you know, certainly during the election, our swing was greater than it had been since Clement Attlee in 1945. So the overall vote share wasn't quite as much as Blair's 97 landslide, but the swing was. And so I think, you know, in spite of what all the polls did to us before, the reality was pretty grand for us.
It seemed like, although some people were still criticizing the campaign right until pretty much the end, you know, there were also even some people who had been critical were definitely starting to come around even before the election actually happened, in terms of saying, like, we think that, you know, Corbyn is performing better in the media, you know, handling the debates better than expected, that kind of thing, which who knows if that's a fair or unfair assessment based on just expectations. But, you know, that there was that element. There was also, I found the some of the media stuff was pretty effective that the party released, like the long form, you know, party information ads. I don't know how much people actually watch those. I think typically I've heard that people really kind of tune out of them because they're like 5 minutes long and you can just like go get a, you know, a soda or whatever. But yeah. But some of them, you know, they were really, they were, it was a fascinating balance because they had struck this kind of mix of both very emotional political appeals like a campaign should do, but also very factual. So there was no way people weren't able to say credibly, like, you know, that this is some pie in the sky campaign that is just making all these promises without having worked out any of the details, because they had this detailed manifesto that was fully, you know, priced out in terms of the revenues necessary and how they were going to get to that, that sort of thing. And these ads that they were doing would say, like, you know, if the austerity cuts from the Tories go through, you know, the NHS will be affected in these specific ways. And they would have these like doctors testifying about it. And it's such a huge contrast from, say, the ads that ran in 1997, which were like also 5 minutes long, but were literally just like Tony Blair and a crowd of like diverse, happy people, like walking down the street, being all excited about the future of the country. And, you know, I guess those are two different ways of doing campaigns, and they're both effective in their own way, I suppose. But it seems like this is a better fit for the time period now rather than then, even though some people thought that maybe like Corbyn was running too much of a, you know, intellectual, nerdy campaign that wasn't going to connect with voters. But of course, as I've said, like, voters know what that something is happening to them, and they would prefer to have it explained to them. And it's better to have an explanation from the left than an explanation that's made up and horrible from the right.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is, you know, as a member of the Labour left, and, you know, as someone who works in solidarity with my comrades on the Labour left, we do have this sort of near constant fight, this Sisyphean fight where, you know, members of the labor right say, well, don't use the word neoliberalism because, you know, the normal people don't understand these words, or, you know, you can't say socialism because they don't get what that means. You can't talk about taxes. You can't talk about all these things because they're too smart for the working class who are too dumb to understand these things. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you say people know what's happening to them. And, you know, they feel, you know, very profoundly the impacts of austerity. And in a visceral way, I think a lot of people who, you know, like myself, who are very middle class people who are cushioned in a lot of ways just by sort of the safety of, you know, at least some degree of, you know, capital security. You know, people who are working on 0 hours contracts, who are carers, who are disabled, who, you know, might be students who down in England are racking up thousands of pounds of student loans. They get what these things feel like. They get what this phenomenon feels like in a very visceral manner. And for people, you know, albeit on the right wing of the Labour Party, but in the Labour Party, to have for so long said, well, you know, you're kind of the lesser caste in society. You're sort of one of the weaker intellectual ones. So what we'll do to you is we'll show you pretty pictures, right? We'll show you smiley faces, you know, happy people, because that's really all of your intellectual capacity. You really can't handle more than that. Well, Jeremy Corbyn came around and said, well, we're going to treat people like people. You know, no one is inherently smarter than another person. And there's no reason that we should be talking to people who have been, you know, crushed at the hands of Tory austerity, like their children who haven't made it through high school, who can't read books. You know, Corbyn, I think, made a very intelligent political choice when he decided to treat people like people and stop treating, you know, the selectorate as this sort of massive idiots. He treated them like people who could think and read and understand and, you know, formulate arguments of their own. And he gave them the numbers and the data they needed to do to make the case for socialism. And, you know, he had faith in young people who turned out massively for him, even though everyone, including people on the labor right, said, well, let's not think of the young kids. Let's not cater to them. We'll just hit farther right. We'll promise we won't let more immigrants in, and that will bring back sort of the people who will actually turn out to vote for us. But yeah, I think, you know, all things considered, we ran a very, very smart campaign that put a lot of faith in people. And it turns out people are worth putting their faith in. If you give them something to believe in, they will fight for it.
Yeah, it was definitely very encouraging. And like I said, even though it had these details and treated people like they were smart, which is good, there were also very easy to understand emotional appeals, rhetorical appeals. The slogan was great, for the many, not the few. I mean, that's got to be one of the top left slogans that's been run in any developed democracy in quite a few decades at this point. I absolutely love that. And I also, like, I agree with you, you know, there's been all these studies, especially in the United States, of kind of the rhetorical complexity of political speeches over time. And that's something that I studied when I was in college as well for my thesis. And, you know, even in relatively expanded franchise periods, so not when it was just limited to, you know, property owners or whatever, and white males, Even after that, there was a long period where political speeches were complicated speeches. I mean, they would have rhetorical appeals, but they, you know, they had complicated sentence structure and word choices, and they treated people like adults and didn't patronize them. And that's how politicians, you know, got elected for many years. And that's how ideas were communicated and the public was moved. And so it's, you know, this notion like that there's no sort of middle ground between totally dumbed down appeals and making absurdly technical appeals that no one can follow that are too, I mean, even, you know, some people have pointed out like Hillary Clinton's campaign website, which she kept on referring people like say, oh, go check out the website or whatever, because she wasn't saying what she was actually for during the debate appearances and stuff like that. If you went to the website, it was Jonathan Cohns described it as a Pinterest page of just like random scattered things that have, there was not even a visual organization, you know, and so that was not even a particularly complicated campaign message, and they still managed to like bog it down in all these disconnected details. Even the manifesto for Labor, which we've talked about on a previous episode, that was pretty well constructed and definitely very easy to read. And it also was a lot less divisive, I thought, than some of the past manifestos. I looked, you know, just immigration specifically, if you compare to the 2010 manifesto, the 2015 manifesto, even some further back, there were some pretty harsh words regarding immigrants and the role of immigrants. And that was a total 180 this year on that. Which I thought was great. The other thing, though, besides all this messaging talk and media talk that I wanted to get into, was about how the campaign was run on the ground. This is something that I've definitely been very interested in for a while because, you know, I started doing door knocking and that kind of stuff back in the 2008 campaign, which is when it kind of really became a huge fixture in the United States. And there was also obviously a lot of phone banking going on, that sort of thing. There's been a lot of talk about how some of the field operations were bungled in the United States in 2016, but we've definitely seen from 2008 and 2012 that you can, if you have an inspiring candidate that can activate a ton of volunteers and you have a good field plan, you can reach a ton of people. Like in 2012, they called more people from the Obama campaign than the entire population of the UK. But in the UK, this was like pretty much brand new, as I understand it, or pretty close to it in terms of direct voter contact. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what, who was involved with that and what happened differently this time from, say, past elections.
Right. So I think there are two sort of little bits of recent history that are worth noting. So I think door knocking as a political tool isn't actually all that new to the UK. It was pretty much pioneered here in, at least in the Western sense. And, you know, I have friends who have been out on, you know, the Labor doorstep, as we call it. You know, in 2005, even some folks who are a little bit older who were doing it in 97. And what door knocking then was sort of just voter ID. You would go out, knock the door. Hi, sorry to bother you. What party are you for? Oh, you're voting Labor. Great, thanks, bye. And they left. And that was sort of the beginning, middle, and end of contact with voters during election campaigns. And then you would do, you know, limited phone banking. But again, that was just voter ID. What was new this time was voters. And I will say, particularly on the Momentum Labor left side, encouraged by former Bernie campaigners to have conversations with people on the doorstep. And what really changed this time around was that, like I said before, we started treating people like people. They were no longer statistics. They were people worth having a conversation with. And, you know, our voter contact rate was, I think, up by 30% but we are having longer, more meaningful conversations with people on the doorstep. We were talking about, you know, what's life like for your kids? What's life like for your gran? You know, how are you feeling? Is there a community center in your area? Do you want a community center in your area? That sort of conversation that really not only endears yourself to people, but really makes you have to think about the people, the voters, of which you are one, as just another person. So that was, I think, one of the really revolutionary things we did, was go out and have long conversations with people. And it's actually a tactic that, besides being adapted from the Bernie campaign, was adapted from the Green Party here in the UK, who is particularly in Scotland, where they know they're not going to get your first preference vote, but they want your second preference vote. And the only way they're going to do that is by talking to you. And then I would say the other thing of recent history, well, I guess not so recent history, but of institutional history, is the Labour Party is quite federalized in how it behaves. So it's very decentralized. So each area, each constituency has a constituency Labour Party known as a CLP. And they have their own branch structures, committees, executive committees, so on and so forth. And they have the ability to select who they run in their elections. And they also have access to data. So a lot of these voter get out the vote, go TV operations are started and run by the CLPs. And they'll run door knocking, they'll run canvassing, they'll run phone canvassing, all of the above. So it's a very localized process, which I think really lends itself to success in a lot of ways, because you're not bussing people in from halfway across the country. It's people from the hood who know what's up. But I think one of the things that Momentum did really, really well, and I have to give them credit for this because I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard when I first saw it, was this website called My Nearest Marginal, which allowed voters and volunteers and activists to put their postal code in and figure out where the nearest marginal they should go work in was. So, well, for me, I live in Scotland, which is a hotbed of political activity right now. So my nearest marginal was out my front door, a constituency over, a constituency north, and a constituency west, all around me. But for people in, you know, the Tory shires, as we call them, it might have been easier for them to go to London and door knock, and they would have had a bigger impact there. And so Momentum set that up, and I think that really helped a lot of people, particularly students on university campuses who had the option to register at their university or at their constituency back home. But then I also think one of the really, really important things was how the Labour Party under Corbyn played this election, was that we didn't view it as a defensive. There's a story that's sort of still in the works, coming out, leaking out in little bits and pieces, that the bureaucracy of the Labour Party, run by General Secretary Ian McNichol, had wanted to end fund the election to be a defensive election, so that we would be minimizing losses rather than making gains.
And I guess that would be similar to in the late 80s, the first time that Neil Kinnock led the campaign into a general election, they pretty much almost openly were like, well, we're going to lose to Thatcher, but here's our, you know, defensive effort to try to mitigate losses. And he was preserved as leader, but it did not go very well, and didn't, you know, I guess there's two factions of the party who view that very differently as whether or not that was a good idea.
Right. Well, and this is the thing is, you know, for the at least the factional side of Labour politics, Ian McNichol represents a very far right wing faction of the party who, in a lot of ways, were very much looking to sabotage this election, as they had looked to sabotage the by-elections in Copeland and Stoke-on-Trent, because they were looking to make a point. They weren't looking to do politics. They weren't looking to make people's lives better. They were looking to oust Jeremy Corbyn. So at least the bureaucratic side of the Labour Party may well have been, if these stories are to be believed, looking to fight a defensive election that wouldn't have won anything. Whereas Corbyn and John McDonnell, who's the shadow chancellor and Corbyn's longtime right-hand man, played a very smart campaign where they went into hard Tory seats and gave people something to believe in. And they played a hard offensive campaign, really, really brave stuff that I think, you know, well, I can't really think of anyone who, you know, had the gutsiness to sort of do that on the Labour front bench or back bench. Any of the people they sort of ran against Corbyn, I don't think would have had the gutsiness to do it. But, you know, we ended up winning places like Canterbury, like I said.
I noticed that on even election day itself, people were still very puzzled by kind of the distribution of which seats, you know, he had traveled to, because he was actually campaigning and doing campaign appearances and stuff in, you know, what were considered to be safe Tory seats. Definitely a lot of the marginals. He wasn't campaigning a lot in the quote unquote Labor seats. And some people seemed to think that that was a misguided approach. But of course, the results seem to indicate otherwise, that they really put some things into play, which, of course, partly that's to do with the size of the districts, the constituencies in the UK, as opposed to like the United States, where, you know, the US, you're talking about a congressional district of like 800,000 people, maybe, whereas it's only about 68,000 in the UK. So the difference between something being in play and something being quote unquote safe is not actually that much. So some of those huge rallies, I mean, that's a lot of people potentially that you're getting either as volunteers or actual voters.
Right. Well, and I think it also, because there was this very conventional, and I think British politics, if, you know, quite terribly for them, have been Americanized a lot in the past couple of years. And so this pundit class really, really believed in the idea of safe seats. And one of the biggest takeaways from, you know, election morning at 6 a.m. while all of us were picking ourselves off the floor along with our jaws, was that there is no such thing as a safe seat anymore. I mean, up here in Scotland, where the SNP had, 50% of the vote in 2015 in their major landslide, they lost a massive amount of seats, and they lost two of their biggest party figures in seats that should have been, you know, safe for them if they had run a good campaign. And I think really the big takeaway for all political parties, but especially for the left, is that we can't write anywhere off, because everywhere is winnable. I mean, the example of Canterbury, but also Kensington, which is simultaneously one of the most wealthy and least wealthy constituencies in the UK, which is the site of the Grenfell fire, which I think we're talking about later. But yeah, then a lot of other areas, like the place I used to live in London, Hampstead and Kilburn constituency, which is a profoundly wealthy area, is quite firmly Labour. And we almost won Golders Green and Finchley in London, which is also a very conservative, was Margaret Thatcher's constituency for a long time, Labour almost took. And I think one of the things that was really exciting for me was looking at all of the places that Theresa May had visited were seats that were more likely to swing Labour, whereas all of the seats Jeremy Corbyn went to didn't swing Tory, swung Labour. So in a lot of ways, Theresa May was one of our best campaigners, one of our best volunteers.
Yeah, she was abysmal on the campaign trail. That was like shocking how bad she was. I knew, I gave her a lot less credit before the election than a lot of people did, just because I thought, you know, she was a borderline accidental prime minister who could never possibly have won from the opposition if she were running, you know, to become prime minister from the opposition. Yeah. You know, but she really lowered the bar even further than I thought she would.
I know. It's really, God, what was it? Meltdown May, make June the end of May.
Yeah. We're going to go to a quick break from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line from Scotland with me is Emily Robinson, a socialist organizer with the Labour Party, who is originally from the United States. We're talking this week about the 2017 UK elections and the aftermath of that. What did you think, though, in terms of like these big rallies that were happening? You know, that was another thing where like the pundit class totally wrote those off. And it seems like when you're dealing with districts that small, that's actually a pretty big achievement to get a rally together that big.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think one of the things is, in sort of this pretentiousness that's just intrinsic in anyone who writes for, you know, The Guardian or The Telegraph or whatever other assorted British paper here, was that they wrote off these rallies because they were all kids and they were like, well, you know, university students will never turn out to vote for you. The youth don't care. They're lazy and they're entitled and they won't show up. And then the youth did show up. And I mean, it's just, you know, there's this sort of electricity in the air. Even now, a couple weeks after the election, if you watch, you know, some of the events at Glastonbury over the past couple days, where even before Corbyn arrived, the pre-radio headset where, you know, spontaneously people started, you know, chanting, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn," it's absolutely electric. And these rallies, I think, were sort of the the breeding ground for this electricity that, you know, really galvanized young people to get out, hit the pavement, knock the doors, and take this election away from the Tories and really sort of destroy what the Tories are. And I think the people who turn their noses up at not only Jeremy Corbyn, but at the rallies and this idea of playing an offensive campaign with a radical and proudly left, well, proudly socialist manifesto, were proven resoundingly wrong and, you know, kind of proved that they're pretty much frauds. They really don't know what politics is about.
Right. I mean, yeah, that the idea of grand politics and big ideas campaigns has been totally lost on them at some point. And I think also, I mean, the point that I always keep coming back to is just that in order to run a campaign like the, you know, the persuasion conversations on the doorsteps, that kind of thing, you have to have a ton of volunteers to do that. You can never possibly come up with enough money to, you know, or there's limits in some cases in some countries, you know, in terms of campaign money. You're not going to be able to just hire people to do that. It's not going to get those results. In order to actually pull it off, you have to have mobilized a massive volunteer army. And the notion that you're going to get that by running these milquetoast centrist candidacies and campaigns is just delusional. I mean, you know, again, even the difference between 2012 and 2016 in the United States is a big, big factor in that is just the manpower available to each campaign, you know, was significantly reduced because people were just a lot less excited. And this idea of like just kind of berating people for, you know, oh, the young people, they should just show up to vote or whatever. And it's like, okay, but you also need them to volunteer. You also need them to do all these other things. And they're not going to do that unless the campaign is at least partially centered on them and is giving them a thing, which people also seem to have forgotten that, again, that's what grand politics is about. You offer a bunch of stuff to a bunch of different constituencies in your party or whatever, or your potential party coalition until you've assembled a coalition that can actually win. And right. they seem to have forgotten that. Let's talk about election aftermath though. Obviously you were saying, you know, this was even the day after was still kind of a huge shock in a good way. And you mentioned earlier that there's kind of this unstable minority government sort of aided questionably by the DUP, which is this like far right Protestant party that didn't even agree to the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. That has been really dicey for the conservative government. You were saying that you think that Corbyn hasn't changed that much since the election. To my mind, though, he at least looks like he's acting more like he's the prime minister in waiting and just more kind of confidence, not in a bad way, but like just like that he feels like that he's going to be prime minister very soon. Is that likely? I've seen different analyses in terms of the, you know, possibilities of another election being called pretty quickly, that sort of thing. I don't know if you have any insights into that.
Right. So I think there's a couple ways to look at the potential of a new election being called. One is, you know, the Tories might realize of their own accord, you know, come October that what they've got going is just not working, that, you know, potentially violating the Good Friday Agreement for the sake of keeping a government isn't necessarily the smartest idea for the union, for anyone else. And they might call come October another snap election, which would be hilarious because we will win again. But what also might happen, and if the report, God, I can't remember what it, if it was the Telegraph, something came out this morning that it appears the Lib Dems and Labour are in talks, are in negotiations for a no confidence vote in the Tory government, in which case we might be looking at an election now, which I think would be very, very exciting. But I also think, regardless of whether or not there's another election, I think what Jeremy Corbyn is doing and what Jeremy Corbyn has proven is that, you know, purely parliamentary politics don't really matter so much anymore. You know, there's this sort of joke going around that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, even though he's not actually prime minister, he's the people's prime minister. Yeah. He was to talk to the, you know, the victims of the fire at the council house and Grenfell. He was the first politician on the scene at Finsbury Park. He's been connecting with people in a very prime ministerial way, you know, as insofar as, you know, parliamentary duties of prime ministers go. But I think, you know, he has proven that you don't just have to have control of parliament to be a, you know, a strong political force. You have to capture sort of the imagination and the will of the voters. You know, Macron in France is, you know, president and has an overwhelming majority in the legislature, but he doesn't really have all that much political capital because no one really believes in him. Whereas Jeremy Corbyn, who isn't prime minister and doesn't have yet the majority in parliament, has shown that he in fact has a massive amount of political capital at his disposal and really can sort of set the narrative. I mean, this idea of expropriating houses, requisitioning houses after Grenfell, luxury homes in Kensington.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, actually.
Sure thing.
What was this fire that happened, and how did kind of the narrative continue to evolve from there?
Right. So Britain has, and you know, as a socialist, this is very exciting for me, but Britain has a long history of social housing after the Attlee government in 1945, but even sort of lightly extending to post-World War I governments, you know, the idea of giving a home for the heroes. But there's this wonderful tradition of council housing, which is state housing in the UK provided for those who need it. Unfortunately, in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea, and as we found out today, in almost every single other council block in the UK, this cosmetic cladding was applied to the outside of the council estate to make it more palatable for the rich people who lived around it, who didn't like the idea of having to look at poverty and having to acknowledge that poverty existed in their wealth echo chambers. And this fire started, I believe, and I believe it was confirmed in a fridge in one of the council or one of the flats. And what happened was this cladding on this cosmetic cladding on the building was incredibly flammable, but also created an air chute, a wind tunnel for deadly gases. I think cyanide was one of the ones cited that killed something like 79 people with hundreds more missing, you know, shot this building on fire in a very short amount of time, but also in just one of the most catastrophic and devastating ways highlighted a massive issue with the way wealth and capital behave in the UK, but also in the US, which is that, you know, the humanity of poor people is degraded and stolen so that, you know, wealthy people don't even have to recognize the problems in their society, the problem of poverty. You know, this cladding wouldn't have existed if the people in Kensington and Chelsea could have just gotten over themselves and acknowledged that they were going to have to look at some brutalist architecture and not, you know, a skyscraper or another terraced home. Instead, they had to look at, you know, well, they had to kill people basically to make themselves feel better. They had to see something nice, and in wanting to see something nice, 79 people are dead. But what this has led to is a massive sort of overhaul of the way we view social housing in the UK. There's a litany of investigations that have been opened, including manslaughter directly for the people in charge of Grenfell, but also it's a conservative, a Tory council. In Kensington and Chelsea completely bungled the aftermath, and it had to be handed over to a Labour council in a neighboring constituency to you know, take over. And one of, I think, the most sort of jarring but really sort of hope-building moments was when Jeremy Corbyn came out and demanded the requisitioning of luxury flats, which, like in New York, where something like 25% of all apartments in New York sit empty for like 9 months of the year. Same thing happened happens in Kensington and Chelsea, where luxury flats are used as land banks. Jeremy Corbyn came out and said, well, we'll have none of that. No houses sitting empty while people have to live on the street. We're taking these luxury flats and we're going to put the victims of this Grenfell fire in them. And what happened was Jeremy Corbyn was so popular and had so much political capital behind him that Theresa May had to take a knee to him. And the Tories had to come out and say, yeah, okay, fine, we'll give a luxury block in a $25 million or £25 million building to the victims of Grenfell. And Corbyn managed to come out and prove to people that, you know, socialism has a response, and that, you know, this violent act of, you know, sabotage by the wealthy against the poor was an act of class warfare. 79 people were dead, and, you know, the Tory party kind of just wanted to push it away and pretend it didn't happen and just continue on playing patron to the wealthy people of Kensington and Chelsea who had blood on their hands because of this.
Yeah, and I heard that if they had not taken this step, then people would have probably been relocated to entirely other parts of the country, not even within, you know, the same city. And, you know, whether or not Jeremy Corbyn actually expected his proposal to happen, he certainly demonstrated very effectively that if you make a more extreme demand, then you're going to get at least a reasonable compromise in the middle, as opposed to no deal at all in the middle, you know. And it was also remarkable to me that, you know, he floats this idea. The same people that dismissed him for years now immediately dismiss that as, oh, nobody will ever go for that. And I was like, no, that people are pretty sympathetic to fire victims who've lost everything. I think this might actually be popular. And he doesn't present it like with any hesitation. He presents all these ideas like just on a factual basis, this is the correct course of action. And then, you know, they did a public opinion poll and he had majority support, like more than 50% of the country immediately agreed with this requisition idea that was supposedly out of this world, you know, too possible, you know, way too radical to even consider. And then this compromise solution of taking, you know, luxury flats that weren't being used in this block that was available and having the government pay for those. You know, they didn't, I don't think they like took it away from actual homeowners, but it was available and they gave them that option. And so these people didn't have to be relocated. And I thought that was a really encouraging sign. Also, it seemed like it emerged that a couple of years back, Corbyn had tried to put some more safety measures in a housing bill. Well, you know, in the opposition, and the Conservatives voted it down. And it turns out that, you know, this was pretty much, you know, could have potentially saved lives, if not there in a similar situation. And the landlord faction in Parliament just really voted that down.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, the fact that, you know, Corbyn and members of the Labour Party were warning that something like this would happen years and years and years ago, I think speaks to sort of this strength of principles and of morality that Corbyn and, you know, Diane Abbott comes to mind, especially considering all of the abuse she's faced over her 30 years, but John McDonnell as well. You know, these people have had this sense of morality instilled in them, and they have fought wholeheartedly for it. And time again, they're proven right, and they are proven over and over and over again that they know what's going on and that they realize, you know, what these mechanisms are and how they, you know, violently oppress people. And I think that the landlord, 60 landlords voted against making, well, the bill was to make housing habitable, was, I think, something in line with human rights. So, you know, that degree of, you know, base level, you should have a sprinkler in a multi-flat building. And what was shocking to me was the firemen union came out and said, well, there's never been a death in a fire where there's been an adequate sprinkler system. And instead of, you know, spending the £25,000 it would have taken to put in a sprinkler system, instead they spent millions of pounds putting on this cladding. And they were allowed to do that because the Tories voted against the bill that would have forced them to put the sprinkler in. And so 79 people are dead and hundreds more displaced. But, you know, I guess it's in this very tragic way, it speaks to the inhumanity of the Tory party. They have for so long lived on the other kind of estate, the fox hunting kind of estate, that where they don't have to meet poor people except as their servants, and they don't see humanity in other people, and in so doing have lost their own humanity themselves. They think that turning a profit on a property by not implementing basic safety features is more important to them than making sure people are alive and people are able to continue living at a certain degree of comfort, because certainly right now there's no degree of comfort afforded to people. And I think, you know, what the left has promised is that people can live in a safe and comfortable world where profit doesn't take precedent. It's people that take precedent. To steal the language from a Trotskyist party over in Northern Ireland, you know, people over profit. But I think, you know, this is just one of those heartbreaking moments that I think will definitely be recorded in history books for how sort of seriously it changed the way people look at politics. It's no longer something that happens, you know, hundreds of miles away in the capital. It's something that happens at your doorstep and affects, you know, the people closest to you. And I think that will be, you know, a great awakening of sorts for a lot of people in this country and a lot of people abroad.
I had definitely seen a number of comparisons of saying this was similar to, maybe somewhat smaller, but you know, still pretty comparable to the Hurricane Katrina, where a lot of people realized that this supposedly, you know, so-called compassionate conservatism really wasn't compassionate at all, and it was, you know, anything to save a buck, even when there were specific warnings about you need to fix X, Y, and Z in order to prevent this exact disaster from happening. And also, I think, you know, an excellent point that you made is that one of Corbyn's strengths, one of Abbott's strengths, politically lately has just been, you know, they're not necessarily going around saying, ha ha, we were right. I mean, that would be a terrible thing to say. And so they never say that on any of these issues, whether it's the fire or literally anything else. But the fact is, they have been right for so long on so many issues. And everyone knows that they've been right. And especially the younger people. I saw there was a Guardian quote from one of the Blairite MPs who had kind of come around after, you know, either right before or after the election. And she was like the day after the election, I think she was speaking at a university and asking, you know, it seems like all of you guys are really into, you know, Corbyn. I'm just curious, like, what specifically appeals, you know, to you about him? And they all said, you know, specifically things like his anti-apartheid activism and that kind of thing. And like many of them probably were born after, almost certainly all of them were born after, you know, that era. And but they're just aware that, like, this guy, also Abbott, also McDonnell, they were on the right side of history when it was deeply unpopular to be on the right side of history. They never wavered. They never went, you know, along with the rest of the crowd. You know, the Tony Blair's whole New Labor stuff, they never went along with that. They did their own thing. They've been right consistently on everything, and that has value, that has cachet. I mean, obviously that's a similar reason of why a lot of people were drawn to Bernie Sanders, but a lot of people would say, like, Corbyn, even more so than Bernie Sanders, has consistently been on the right side of history.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the things that I, you know, the right wing of the Labour Party has been all about building their resumes, and for them it's, you know, whatever next step in the career ladder will get them closest to power. And, you know, if Labour were to fall apart right now and we were to have zero seats tomorrow morning, they would immediately jump to the Lib Dems with no sort of personal politics change.
Right.
Whereas, you know, people like, and I really want to sing the praises of Diane Abbott because she gets hammered by everyone. She has not been cut an ounce of slack in the 30 years she's been in politics. And, you know, she has been a radical Black woman in a country where being Black is radical in and of itself, but then to carry on and be, you know, an outspoken socialist right on the foreign policy issues, right on the domestic issues, right on the social issues pertaining to Black people, pertaining to women, pertaining to gay people, even including apartheid, you know, she's been right on all of these things in a way that most of her colleagues who are white women have not been. You know, you get, God, Labour MP Jess Phillips went on some talk show a couple years back and, you know, made Diane Abbott out to be a literal gorilla and was not sort of faced with any backlash. But, you know, Jess Phillips is also allocated so many inches in The Guardian to talk about how hard it is to be a white woman, you know, whereas Diane Abbott has been around being a radical socialist woman and has received basically no solidarity. So I want to give that particular shout out to her, especially because she increased her majority more than Jeremy Corbyn did,
yeah,
which is worth noting.
Very
in a
popular.
Lot of, yeah, she is. But despite what the media will say, people love Diane Abbott because she's worth loving. But I think it does speak to this level of, you know, career politics is over. It's about being the best moral person you can be. It's about, you know, I get a bit cheesy about this, but like, it's about truly loving one another. Even if you don't like one another, it's about truly loving one another and working for that and making sure that, you know, even the least of us is treated like the most of us. And I think that sort of politics is being rewarded, and that sort of selfless camaraderie is being rewarded in a way that, you know, the Yvette Coopers of the world who are conniving and constantly looking for the next rung on the career ladder won't be rewarded again. You know, this is, that politics is over. People want authenticity. They want something to believe in, not a resume generator.
Now, closing thoughts here in our final minutes. You know, when we last talked in November, you were obviously more optimistic about the chances within the Labour Party than, say, the Democratic Party. But sticking with Labour, how optimistic are you feeling in terms of your faction, the socialist, the left faction within the Labour Party? How confident are you about the chances of kind of consolidating control? You know, is there any sign that the Blairites are broadly coming around at all? Is there anybody, you know, putting aside their ego here? What's the sentiment? Is there still this endless risk of sabotage like there was in 2015, 2016? Or is there pretty good cause for hope that things are going to continue to improve within Labour and then in the next general election?
Right. So I think the left in Labour is stronger than it has been since 1945. And I think the left Labour is the strongest left-wing political force in the Western world right now. So for that, I'm immensely optimistic. And, you know, even Clement Attlee, who is considered one of Labour's best prime ministers and probably one of the best prime ministers in the UK's history, was also faced several attempted coups and rode those out. But I think the thing is, the Labour left shouldn't really care if the Blairites are coming around because they're irrelevant now. They've been outnumbered. Their support, Lord Sainsbury, who funded Progress, which is this awful rag of you know, quote moderation, but is really just, you know, capitalism with a smiley face painted on, has pulled his funding. They are now irrelevant. People have joined this party en masse. You know, I've got people from the Scottish Greens, from the Lib Dems who have realized that, you know, capitalism is no longer the way. I've got people from the SNP who are joining in, are enthusiastic about getting out there and doing the work. And the Blairites just, they don't have that anymore. Their numbers are dwindling. So I'll be more than happy to welcome them over if they can put their egos aside. I doubt that they can. They seem like they're fighting the whole way, but people are really enthused about Labour and they're enthused about Jeremy Corbyn and they're here to do the work, the hard work, because they found that solidarity. So I am, in spite of my incessant need to be a pessimist, I am fantastically optimistic. I think the future is very bright.
And things are looking better in Scotland for Scottish Labour yet, or how are we doing on that front?
I think we're getting there. I think there's a really funny, I think it's the Sunday Herald today, where they were showing three leaders and three visions of Scotland's future in Europe. And it was Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Tories, Scottish Tories, Nicola Sturgeon, First Minister and SNP, obviously, and then Jeremy Corbyn, not Kezia Dugdale, who's the right-wing Labour leader of Scottish Labour. So I think we're going to reform Scottish Labour. I think we're getting there. But as a whole, I'm incredibly optimistic.
All right. Well, Emily Robinson, thank you so much for coming back to talk about these exciting developments in the United Kingdom for the Labour Party.
Thanks for having me on.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.